3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Good morning, folks. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I'm in the studio with Inez and Alice. Good morning.
Good morning, Priya. Good morning, Alice.
How are you guys going?
Doing okay. How are you?
It's okay.
I'm good. I've just been frantically obsessing over this amazing exclusive interview that we have on.
Yeah, that's right.
And how amazing this show is. I've just been pumped about it for the entire week, to be honest.
3CR exclusive, Peter Cronow. Extremely exciting to have Peter choose our show. And I think we've all benefited so much from the work that Declassified Australia has been doing for a long time, but especially since the genocide began. Also, I was just reflecting on the acknowledgement of country, and I think yesterday is the first time that I've heard somebody do an acknowledgement of country in Palestinian Arabic, and it was so beautiful. I went to see my friend present on some of her work, and it was, yeah, I don't know. It was really nice. It was really nice to hear.
Yeah, it sounds special.
Yeah. All right, we've got, as you mentioned, Inez, a big and very important show today. And do you want to kick us off, maybe, Alice, with what we've got on?
Sure. Coming up first, we've got a speech delivered by Palestinian playwright, poet, scholar, and political commentator Dr. Sameh Sabawi as part of the National Day of Action for Palestine on the 13th of October. In the recording, you'll hear Dr. Sabawi speaking to a crowd gathered outside the State Library of Victoria.
And then after that, we're going to be joined by Northern Territory-based barrister John Lawrence, who's going to speak with us about his recent legal defense of direct actioners who shut down the access road to the Pine Gap Signals Intelligence Facility outside of Infanta Alice Springs in solidarity with Palestine. And John is also going to talk about Australia's international legal obligations with respect to the International Court of Justice and International Criminal Court decisions on Gaza and the West Bank.
Coming up after that, we'll have Eugenia Lim, artist, filmmaker, and educator, in studio to have a live interview discussing her film Metabolism.
And then finally, we have the 3CR exclusive from Priya Crota, who is the editor of Declassified Australia, who joined me this week to discuss the shocking discovery that at least 69 now, since last week, of F-35 fighter jet parts, likely many more, have been flown on commercial passenger planes to Israel from Australia. Leaked documents have revealed. This comes after years of denial by the Department of Defense, Parliament members, and Prime Minister saying Australia does not supply weapons or parts to Israel and hasn't done so for more than 5 years. Well, these documents say otherwise. And Peter Crota is a highly esteemed investigative journalist and producer for ABC's TV Four Corners. And Declassified Australia does really important work such as Pine Gap and whistleblowers for declassified documents. So we play part one and then part two next week about the Freedom of Information request and what the Williamtown base means for the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah, and I think it'll be so important to hear that part about the Williamtown base as well, because I remember we had a conversation with the No Weapons for Genocide crew a couple of months ago where we were talking about, this whole process across so-called Australia where various communities that have been involved in particular kinds of industrial production, manufacturing related to the extractive industries are now retooling up to further intensify military production and transit. So thanks so much, Inez. I'm really keen to hear this interview. All right, we will be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 16th of October. The Rapid Support Forces in Sudan have launched a sweeping and violent campaign in South Darfur, detaining dozens of civilians, teachers and local officials they accuse of cooperating with the Sudanese armed forces. Now, people in South Darfur described Rapid Support Forces units arriving with lists of targeted names, taking people directly from their homes and transferring around 70 detainees to prisons. Now, human rights monitors across Africa have condemned the so-called arrests, reporting that the Rapid Support Forces is using prisons to hold detainees from across Darfur and Kordofan as it tightens control over education and public institutions.
Also in headlines, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are making the trek to return north in Gaza to streets and homes decimated by Israel. Palestinians continue to face attacks from the Israeli army despite the so-called ceasefire, with soldiers killing at least 9 Palestinians in recent days during neighborhood raids. Israel has paused the promised opening of the Rafah border to Egypt and imposed new restrictions on aid deliveries to Gaza, allowing only half of what was promised under Trump's bluffed peace plan.
In other news, despite growing scrutiny and parliamentary questioning over Australia's government F-35 pipeline to Israel, exports have continued, with another shipment of so-called aircraft parts departing Sydney for Israel this week aboard a passenger plane.
In related news, anti-genocide pro-Palestine activists have again effectively blocked container truck routes in and out of Webb Dock in Port Melbourne this week, calling for weapons companies in so-called Australia to end all trade with Israel. For the fourth time this month, trucks carrying Zim, Maersk, MSC and toll containers were blocked as protesters piled rubble in front of weapons company buildings in a symbolic show of solidarity with Palestinians who were returning home to the destruction of their homes and local areas by Israel.
Finally, in headlines, it's Anti-Poverty Week, and the Anti-Poverty Network is calling on the Australian government to act urgently on poverty and housing. The network is urging the federal government to raise Centrelink payments to the poverty line and end property investor tax breaks. A spokesperson from the network said, quote, "It's a national embarrassment," end quote, that 1 in 7 adults and 1 in 6 children in Australia still live in poverty despite the country's wealth, end quote. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 16th of October. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only 1 out of 4 reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
...3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Now we're going to be listening to a speech delivered by Palestinian playwright, poet, scholar and political commentator Dr. Sameh Sabawi as part of the National Day of Action for Palestine on the 13th of October. In this recording, you will hear Dr. Sabawi speaking to a crowd gathered outside the State Library of Victoria.
Dr. Samah is the founder and director of Hakawiya Productions and a board member of PARA, the Palestine Australia Relief Association. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Samah Sabawi. Free, free Palestine! Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
Ask any Gazan how they're doing. And they'll say, Ish bidna ngul, Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. For the people have returned. 2 years and 3 days leading to this moment when they get to pitch their tent on the remnants of a past life, on deep scars that are etched on their land, on homes now turned to graveyards. Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah, they get to take stock of their losses, count their dead and missing, salvage pieces of loved ones from beneath rubble, and if they're lucky, they can give them a burial. Save a prayer over their souls that have long, long ascended to heaven. Ish bidna nqul ghair alhamdulillah. The mass forced expulsion has been avoided for now. And we can take the time to rejoice in the fact that we can celebrate the clear skies at night, that we can dance to the beat of the 500,000 feet marching back into the arms of their beloved city. And their city, Gaza, oh, how she missed them all. How she has ached for their return. How she has not stopped whispering their name. Their city wants them to love her again, to tend to her wounds, to gather the pieces of her broken heart. Their Gaza, my Gaza, still breathes our name. So what can we say, ghair alhamdulillah? But we all know this ceasefire is not real, especially when it is predicated on injustice. And we know that the hungry still waits for the siege to break, for the gates to open, for the world to be let in, for there to be accountability, not merely words or a recognition of a state that is stripped of all autonomy. Pray tell, Mr. Albanese, how does a state function without a choice over its leaders, without choice over its own democracy? Without border control or contiguity, without autonomy, without security, without an army. It is astounding. It is astounding how we continue to be gaslit by your government. 2 years and 3 days, and I hear some say Israel has lost the war because it didn't achieve its goals. Well, that may be true, but come on. We all knew it was never about releasing the hostages or eradicating Hamas. We all knew that collapsing Gaza was the price. 2 years and 3 days, and we've seen it all. We've witnessed what we could never have imagined would occur. Hospital massacres, babies dismembered, soldiers raping prisoners. And we have witnessed dogs eating our loved ones. And even the humanitarian aid was weaponized. Did you read the headlines? Rising tall in aid-seeking deaths. That was our media. Aid-seeking deaths, as if aid-seeking was an epidemic, as if it's an out-of-control disease confined to Gaza's killing fields. Ish bidna nqul ghair alhamdulillah. Our people have returned to Gaza to wash away its tears, to sweep the horror from its eyes and its streets, And I know my people, and I know they will manage to find beauty in the aftermath of this God-forsaken genocide. I know that prayers and singing will continue to intertwine. I know that they will hang paper lanterns on the ceilings of their tents, and they will forage for flowers to place in empty cans that they will recycle from rubble into guest rooms, into plastic bottles, into solar lights. But first, they need to retrieve the missing bodies. They'll need to pull out their disrupted plans, and they'll need to rescue what remains of their future dreams, and they'll need to find these conversations that were halted and hung on thin threads. And there, beyond the apocalypse, my people know that time still ticks, that the earth still spins and the sun rotates, and even as the whole world turns its back on them and shrugs, beyond the apocalypse, our matriarchs will still shine. They will harvest wild sorrel and khobeza, and they will nourish their loved ones in a way that sustenance can, in a way that only the indigenous woman knows how. And they will say, "Ish bidna nqul ghair alhamdulillah." And their words will echo, "Alhamdulillah," and they will calm the hearts of nameless children with heavy acronyms, "Wounded child, no surviving family." And the cameras now will eventually try to move on and move away, but I urge you, you, all of you here, you must not keep on gathering. And in every city, in every corner in the world, keep on screaming, "Free Palestine! Sanction Israel now!" Please don't stop, because the genocide has not. Thank you. Sanction Israel now!
Sanction Israel now!
Sanction Israel now! What other crimes does Israel have to commit? How many more children do they have to murder? How many people did they have to abduct? Are the numbers not enough? Are their stories not enough before our government will act? We have demanded from day one, not just a ceasefire, but sanctions, boycotts, divestments. Hold this rogue state to account. We have the power and the ability to, yet our government chooses not to. That is a choice. It is their choice. And their choice is active complicity with genocide. Active complicity with apartheid. Active complicity with colonization, ethno-supremacy, ethnic cleansing, and every form of racism you can imagine, because to them, Palestinian bodies do not matter. Our children do not matter.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio File.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio File.
File. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
That was a speech from Palestinian playwright, poet, scholar and political commentator Dr. Sama Sabawi as part of the National Day of Action for Palestine on the 13th of October.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised longing, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is out.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersects where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR, 855 AM, and it is 7:24 in the morning. It's going to be a hot one today. I think it's reaching a high of 31 degrees. So I very optimistically wore shorts and a t-shirt this morning riding to the station because I have a strict policy of not carrying more things with me than I need and was freezing. So I'm really hoping that it warms up. And yeah, it is our pleasure to have in the studio with us John Lawrence, who's a Northern Territory-based barrister, and he joins us to talk about his recent legal defense of direct actioners who shut down the access road to the Pine Gap Signals Intelligence Facility outside of Mbantwa Alice Springs in solidarity with Palestine. And John's also going to talk about Australia's international legal obligations with respect to International Court of Justice and International Criminal Court decisions on Gaza and the West Bank, and much more. So good morning, John.
Good morning.
It's great to have you in.
Yeah, sounds a bit dry. we better weigh up a bit, I think.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know,
anyway.
I feel like I gave people the bare bones introduction, but actually, do you want to give us a bit more of a flavorful introduction to the work that you do?
Oh, never mind me. This is all about two activists and their friends, 50, who, it's 2 years ago now, it was only about 6 weeks after Israel reacted predictably to the 7th of October, that they decided to take direct action, not to protest against Israel's actions of genocide and so forth, but to actually prevent that crime happening, because it's happening in part through the Pine Gap Joint Defence Facility. Because beknownst to any member of the public who wants to avail themselves of the literature on Pine Gap, it's used as an intelligence gatherer from American satellites who are observing Palestine now and then in order to gather data intelligence, which is phone calls, emails, conversations, photographs, so forth. All of that data goes to Pine Gap, who then process it to a degree, and then they pass it on to a similar facility in Washington, D.C., or at least outside Washington, D.C., and then that American facility takes the same and gives it to the Israeli Defense Force, pursuant to an agreement which is public between America and Israel. So, in other words, the people in Pine Gap are aiding and abetting various crimes which exist in Commonwealth law under the Commonwealth Crimes Act, which came into law in 2002. Which accompanied other legislation which aligned Australia to what is called the Treaty of Rome, which puts us in the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. So those crimes have jurisdiction because they're being committed in Palestine, which is a member of the court. Israel's not, but it doesn't get it off the hook. And they're being committed, at least in a preparatory stage, or an aiding and abetting stage, in Alice Springs or Pine Gap. So what they were doing wasn't protesting or demonstrating. What they were doing was, and they were doing it effectively, they stopped literally about 100 employees get into their work over a period of 6 hours that day, which was in November of 2023. Mm. And they were eventually arrested. How they did it was wonderful. And that they blockaded the road off very professionally. And they did it with a way to, well, first of all, it was peaceful. And secondly, it was to prevent any accidents. So they had cones and high-vis and fencing. And they situated it not far from the Stuart Highway so vehicles wouldn't be at a high speed. But they stopped them all. And they themselves, the two that were arrested, had a 44-gallon drum of concrete, and they had both, well, they had their forearms stuck in the middle of this drum. Don't ask me to explain it too much more than that. But it made it very difficult for them to be moved, which hence the 6 hours.
Yeah. I mean, it is really important what you've emphasized there about how this is not a protest or a demonstration, but this is, you know, taking direct action to prevent access to a signals intelligence facility that, you know, Australia is, you know, has basically allowed to be created, is involved in operating, that is part of the Five Eyes surveillance architecture, where Australia is linked into a bunch of other imperialist, colonialist countries to share information that allows atrocities to be perpetrated in Palestine, but also elsewhere. And so I think when we talk about, you know, military intelligence and surveillance, sometimes it can seem a bit abstract, but this is really like quite a concrete example, if you pardon the pun, but a concrete example of people identifying those links and finding out, you know, the best way to disrupt them. In terms of the actual court case, what was the case that was brought against the direct actioners? And, you know, tell us a bit about that process.
Well, they were eventually taken into custody once they were liberated from the 44-gallon drum. And they were charged with several minor offences, two of which were eventually dropped, and they held on to one, which was obstructing the traffic, basically, and being a hazard. So it was a pretty innocuous offence. However, all, you know, and they could have pleaded guilty and got a box of chocolates, probably, but they got a genius of a lawyer who discovered a defence, if you look hard enough. And it was a good defence, and it was that in common law and in the code that applies in the territory, there's a defence which is next door to self-defence, which is you're not guilty of committing a crime if you do something which is to prevent the commission of another offence. So that sat pretty well in most respects, in that they were preventing the commission of these Commonwealth offences, which were genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. The problem they had from the beginning was that that defence applied in the wording of the statute, which included the application of force. So when I first looked at the case, I always thought that might be a hurdle, because ironically they were peaceful and they didn't assault anybody or apply any direct physical force to policemen or whatever, or staff. However, they did force them to not go to work. So we had a pretty good argument. But from the get-go, it was very clear to anybody in the building that the judge was going to find them guilty. So they were eventually found guilty, and they did get that box of chocolates, even although they pleaded not guilty, because he didn't record convictions against them and he didn't fine them. He basically placed them on a good behaviour reconnaissance for 6 months with a victim's levy, which is something everybody gets. So the penalty was appropriately lenient, but the finding was disappointing. But the point of the exercise was really to highlight what was going on in Pine Gap and also show others that they could do the same and have the same defence. And indeed, it's been repeated, I think. Is it this week or last? Last week, yeah.
We spoke about it on the show.
Yeah, so they've did it again. And, I mean, the thing that I really like about it is that it's taken direct action to a different level. And it's the level that direct action needs to go to now in Australia and has gone traditionally in all other forms of progressing society, whether it be suffragettes, Gandhi, Martin Luther King. All these people have taken it to this level. And there are other levels. There are levels where you don't have a defence and you just commit the crime and then you plead guilty and then you don't pay the fine and then you go to prison and then you go on hunger strike. Now, these kind of things are difficult to envisage in 2025 because we're all different now compared with Emily Pankhurst and Gandhi and all these other people. And it's a worry. And the establishment will rely on it heavily. And indeed, the establishment encourages the trepidation and the fear that people have, and it is fear, in doing things like this by bringing in through Parliament massive penalties now, which apply to anybody. So people are scared of losing their jobs, of having any future, of keeping on at university or whatever. So that's a problem. And I don't think there's any way around it other than stepping up and doing it anyway. There's a lot of reasons and explanations and arguably justifications for people being less minded to do what heroes did in the past. But I think it's not, you either do or you don't. Mm-hmm. And if you don't struggle, you don't have progress.
Yeah, I mean, you can't win if you don't fight.
Yeah.
I wanted to come back to something that you mentioned earlier about this case being an opportunity to highlight, you know, what is possible in terms of a defense of direct action. But then that question of highlighting, I think, is, you know, a frustrating one when it comes to our media landscape, where I saw that the coverage of this case was really only in 8CCC community radio in Mbatha. So can you tell me about, like, the discussion of the case and how much traction that's had in terms of actually getting a broader understanding of what went on?
Yeah, great question, Priya, and a very important one, because it opens up the area which is very, very negative for progress or for taking on the status quo, and that is the media are part of the status quo. There's no doubt about it. Whether it's News Corp, which is an obvious example, who showed no interest in it. And, you know, I've been involved in this kind of caper for years, so I have relationships with the media necessarily, and that's News Corp, The Guardian, Sydney Morning Herald, and I buzz these people, and their reaction speaks for itself. Now, The Australian was not interested. The News Corp equivalent in the territory hardly reported it. It was scant, and when the trial happened, they didn't report it. For your listeners, actually, The Guardian is going to write a story on the weekend about it, which, again, is very much to do with an activist's responsibility, which is shaking that tree. So I've spoken to Ben Doherty and given him the oil on it, and he's going to write probably a good story that will be out on the weekend. But, yeah, the point's good. And if you don't have a platform, you know, you're really screaming into the wind, you know. And interestingly, what I noticed, because I'm not really in an activist group as such, or at least I wasn't there. I was their lawyer, but obviously I got to know them all. And I noticed it was a bit of a window into the activist world. And they managed to circulate the story amongst the activist media, which I'm sort of ignorant about, really, although I learnt when I was on the job. But that's really inadequate. It's really listening to your own self, you know, and it really has to go out on, dare I say it, Channel 9 and ABC, because I sincerely believe that if more Australians were accurately informed rather than misinformed, they would come round to taking more action, which is really the problem.
And I think, yeah, it is that lack of, I guess, a lack of attention that kind of is a deliberate strategy by mainstream media suck the oxygen out of the room, to, you know, not provide these conversations with any oxygen, so that people who have way less proximity to activism can say, oh, those people aren't like us, and that's not something that we would do. And it you know, fosters this further risk-averse culture and, you know, identifying that this is not possible. But go ahead, Inez.
Yeah, I was just going to ask for, like, future protesters, what are ways that they can be more prepared or supported in their action? You know, you said that this could set precedent, and there's not only, you know, on the frontline direct action, there's lots of ways to support. So how can you be prepped and supported for future protests?
Yeah, well, I think if if you're an activist, you have different layers of activists. So you'll have activists that are prepared to put their arm in the barrel and get arrested and ultimately go to jail and be executed, if you know what I mean. And then there are other layers that provide support adjacent, and they can go back and back and back. And that's great, because activism's a wonderful thing to do as a person. You know, it's socially excellent. It really uplifts your world in many ways. So, you know, you work out the different layers. But as for legal defences, they're few and far between because of the way the authorities are working. So, you know, there's no great defence to a lot of these things. I really think, and it might be boring about it, but I really think that we've got to a stage now where we either do it and face the establishment status quo consequences, or we don't. And if we don't, we don't. And let's remind ourselves of what we're talking about here, because we're talking about genocide, which is described when it was invented after the Second World War as the crime of crimes, which is wiping out an entire race of people, male, female, young, old, children, babies. And we're talking about the homicides of children, starving children to death, which has to be the end of the world. Mm. And if that's in your living room and you know that's happening, and you've read or you've heard the story of the Good Samaritan, then, you know, we're all brought up to jump in for somebody who's getting the crap belted out of them by somebody bigger or more. I mean, that's in our nature to help other people. And if we're in a state now where we're not only reluctant to do it, we've actually invented a culture of justifying not doing it. We've actually normalized being indifferent. So it's not like I'm indifferent, I'm a prick. It's I'm indifferent because I've got a mortgage, or I've got two kids, or I'll get thrown out of university. Therefore, being indifferent isn't that bad.
Yep.
Whereas being indifferent is the end of the world. If we're indifferent to other people's plights, then it's games up.
Mm.
And that cultural aspect needs to be sheeted home on platforms and by actions that are reported on platforms, by, dare I say it, leaders who can counter the culture that we've been fed for 30 years, which is, you know, the cultural norm now is I'm all right, Jack. You know that expression?
Mm-hmm.
Which means is if you're all right, don't worry about her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, that used to be the opposite of the cultural norm. The cultural norm when I was your age was one for all and all for one. It was about helping people. And in fact, that was stigmatic. That was a pejorative expression that you would use if someone in your company was behaving in a selfish way. You would turn around and go, oh, yeah, I'm all right, Jack. Because that's no way to conduct yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got into that. That's what we do. We're all just obsessed by ourselves, you know, and this is the price you pay. And the price you pay is children being killed. So, you know, we're really, I think, and this action conveniently sums it up in a way.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that are not prepared to say, I'm all right, Jack. These are people that are putting their bodies on the line and saying, I'm going to stop you doing this. And they're great encouragement.
Well, I did actually want to ask on that, because it's a big question about, you know, where the greatest burden of holding that risk falls. And it, you know, it falls on the people that are taking the action. But I'm thinking about the broader culture of the legal fraternity in this country and their risk appetite to actually stick their necks out and defend people who are doing these kinds of actions. Can I get your thoughts on that?
Oh, look, there's no risk in defending anybody. There shouldn't be.
Exactly.
But the legal fraternity are hopeless. They're very bourgeois. They're very normalized to this. I mean, I've observed it. I've previously been the president of the Northern Territory Bar Association. I've previously been president of the Criminal Lawyers Association. In days gone by when they had a fairly activist role, at least in the lobbying scene, by opposing legislation that was about jailing, you know, Don Dale. The legal fraternity where I'm from now is mute, and that reflects society generally. And
sorry, what do you mean by legal fraternity?
Like the legal profession.
Oh, yeah.
The legal profession as organised in, say, the Law Society or the Bar Association. Now, though lawyers per se are individually responsible for upholding the rule of law and due process, principles like that. So they actually have an individual duty. And when they gather together in groups and associations, they used to pursue those things. So we would regularly oppose mandatory sentencing, say, as an example, for kids. We would oppose Don Dale as an inhumane facility, etc., etc. It's not happening now. They've all given up. And that reflects... it reflects society generally, you know, and this has to be turned around. And, you know, there are ways and means of doing it. Platforms are a very important one. This is one, notwithstanding my caveat earlier about it being listened to by supporters. But we really need to get out and get the message. And, of course, we've got political leaders who are basically tits on a bull. They don't represent us. Really anymore. I mean, that what's happening in society as it collapses is that there's a great separation occurring. And like the separation, if I could illustrate this, is like Albanese and Penny Wong sitting in the United Nations 3 weeks ago, listening to the big orange man rant and rave in a completely Hitlerian, bellicose way and do nothing about it. Like, just sit there, mute, and suck it up. They didn't, you know, walk out. They didn't throw a shoe. None of them did. And that very significantly illustrates where, let's call it the West, the liberal democracies, the ones that are left, really, because, I mean, you've got Russia's a dictatorship, India's a dictatorship, China's probably whatever that is, and then you've got America, which is now basically fascist. And so you're left with, let's say, Europe and Australia, New Zealand. We're all going in the same direction.
And it's all, you know, it's all a bunch of countries that are attempting to hold on to their last colonial outposts or their, you know, former imperialist appeals to valor and glory, and willing to move further and further towards a future that is, I don't know, just... you know, becomes untenable for the vast majority of the world, when it already has been untenable for a majority of the world. It's getting more and more cowardly on the one hand and draconian on the other. And I know you have also been doing a lot of work and thinking about, you know, the international arena and Australia's, you know, responsibilities in relation to you know, international legal agreements around the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and their rulings on Palestine. But I was, wondering if we could take it out to that sphere and think about the relationship between countries on these issues, and especially on Gaza.
Yeah, well, Australia now, in law, is arguably obliged to investigate. The federal police could and should be urged to investigate war crimes going on at Pine Gap, because the law requires that. Because with genocide, not only does the law on genocide make it a crime to commit genocide, but it also actually, for good reason, puts an onus on each country to investigate. And if they have any hint that it's going on, then they're obliged in law to look into it. Now, that'll never happen. The Australian Federal Police are investigating war crimes in Afghanistan committed by Australian soldiers. So that illustrates the legal onus that lies with Australia. So it could happen in law. It should happen in law. Independent senators in Parliament, I would suggest, should be making those suggestions in Parliament where we can all hear it. I don't know if they have. I don't think they have, but they should be doing that. They should be getting answers from the Federal Attorney General as to why the Australian Federal Police are not investigating war crimes committed at Pine Gap. That could happen. The other thing is there's two courts that exist. There's the International Court of Justice, which is really between a court that resolves fights between states. And so you're probably aware that a few years ago, South Africa, and they're now being supported by some other South American countries, brought a proceeding in that court to declare that Israel was committing genocide. And the court have come to a view that prima facie, on its face value, that is happening. Israel's just ignored it. The other thing about that is that, so that's that. The International Criminal Court can do individuals. And in November of last year, at the application of, I think, South Africa again, I'm not sure, it might have been Palestine, they've actually issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu and his then defence minister, whose name escapes me.
Yoav Gallant?
Yeah, Gallant. Yeah, that's right. Arrest warrants for both of those jokers. They also issued arrest warrants for Hamas leaders as well, one of whom's dead now. So if Netanyahu comes to Australia, he could and should be arrested.
Actually, I have a point on that around, you know, if these leaders come here, because it also, you know, something that's been very difficult to have any conversation about in mainstream media is the fact that there is a whole group of people who have dual citizenship with Israel, who travel to Israel and have participated in the genocide and are coming back to their countries of origin. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on that and, you know, the responsibilities there, because I know that there are organizations like the Hind Rajab Foundation who are investigating people who hold citizenship with Israel and countries outside of Israel as well, and are returning to their home countries having participated in the genocide.
Well, my understanding of the law is that they're as liable as Benjamin Netanyahu. He's an obvious suspect for committing it because he's the leader of the government that's ordered it. But it applies to individuals. So if you have done your conscripted time in the IDF and you're an Australian citizen as well, and you've done what you've done in Palestine, then you would be up, in my opinion, on the law for being at least investigated, interrogated by the police as to what you did, where, and then a decision would be made whether you were aiding and abetting in a war crime. So they're liable as well. But the politics of reality tell us that Albanese, one of the amazing things about this, let's remind ourselves, is Israel, in my opinion now, Israel has dug its own grave. And let me speak about when I've just come back from the West Bank. But before I go on to that, they've dug their own grave because hardly anybody actually supports them except the ones that count, which is America and us and Britain still. And it's all about capital. It's all about money. It always is. But they have now got themselves into a situation where there should be serious discussion as to whether this country can remain a country, because they are so in the cold and dark by virtue of what they've chosen deliberately to do and will continue to do. Don't be fooled by this peace process. This thing's going to start up probably today. You know, it's just going to keep going. So they are a pariah now.
It returns back to this reiteration of October 7th as, and that's what we see in mainstream media, yeah, and everything else. Yeah. It's coming back to framing yourself as a site of violation in order to justify,
victim.
Yes, in order to justify, you know, the unjustifiable. Now,
but let me just put in my observations of being on the West Bank.
Yeah, because I was going to ask
It sits with that. When I went over there, and I was only there for 10 days, and it was about a month ago, I went to Tel Aviv first, just on my own. I got a tourist visa, and I arrived in Tel Aviv, which is Israel, and I sat there for 2 days just watching as much as I could. And I wandered around and I met people and I spoke to people and I drank coffee and tea and all that with them and just basically smelt the lie of the land. And after 2 days, I then moved across to Bethlehem through Jerusalem, and then I was in the West Bank, and then I made observations there for the following 8 days. But the observations I made about the Israelis were really quite weird and surprising. And the first observation I made was, like, every time I go to any country overseas, my first observation is we're all the same. It confirms that we are really all the same, which is great. We're humanity, and we have the basics of humanity.
We've got to start somewhere.
And, well, we're getting rid of it rapidly. Mm. But, you know, you could just see that everybody's the same, whether in Morocco or Israel. And but then I started smelling what was going on there. And I sensed from the Israelis that I met and spoke to and observed that they were very uncomfortable. They weren't a happy lot. They were worried, anxious. They weren't very friendly. And I eventually reflected, before I hit the West Bank, I had this sort of thought, these guys are sheepish. And they're possibly sheepish because they know what they're doing now is really, really bad. And they haven't done enough to prevent it. And some of them, of course, many of them, of course, support it. And they're also thinking, and this is the thing I thought was fascinating. I actually thought of them. They're thinking they can't win. And then I go to the West Bank, and they're being monstered on every front of oppression, racism, you name it. It's just apartheid. It's more than apartheid. You know, it's the end. And they're walking around with a smile on their face almost. They're like winners.
Yeah.
It was quite amazing. It was like they can't be defeated. So I saw the symmetry of we can't win, we can't be defeated, which is an incredible attitude to take, which involves a lot of the concept of martyrdom. When people die, they're immediately a martyr. It's part of Islam, I presume. Mm. And whatever it is, it allows them to have this chalk and cheese attitude. And so that combined with where it's going and so forth, I think Israel are stuffed, essentially and ultimately. But it's going to be ugly before anything else.
And it's, you know, witnessing the death throes of empire, I once again just want to center that it's Palestinians who are bearing the brunt of this.
Oh.
Yeah, and I mean, it is... I'm glad that you shared those reflections because... Mm. It's not, you know, the erosion of our humanity collectively is something that we actually will have to grapple with materially. You know, what happens? What happens as we move into what comes next? But look, John, we're going to have to wrap up now. Really, really appreciate your time.
No worries.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
again.
Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, I'm speaking tonight.
Yes, that's right.
Come
I
on
will.
Now.
Yes, exactly. Well, look, John, if you give me one moment,
I
will let people know. So we've just been joined by Northern Territory-based barrister John Lawrence, who spoke with us about his recent legal defense of direct actioners, shutting down the access road to the Pine Gap Signals Intelligence Facility outside of Mpantwa Alice Springs in solidarity with Palestine, not just a protest, but actually a direct intervention in preventing these crimes from happening. And we also spoke about Australia's international legal obligations with respect to the ICJ and ICC decisions on Gaza and the West Bank. And John's going to be delivering a lecture today, delving further into these issues at RMIT University's Emily McPherson Building. That is building number 13, level 3, room number 9 from 4 to 5 p.m. The lecture is open to all with no registration required. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 a.m. and it is 7:59. In the morning. Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yen Apasaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m., we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters. Brothers, sisters,
we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters. And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist
freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman, with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR, dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
Environmental Film Festival is back, running from the 16th to the 23rd of October across Melbourne, Footscray, Fitzroy and Elwood. Enjoy Australia's premier environmental cinema showcase with 23 films, 14 premieres, 4 talks and 2 community gatherings, all exploring ideas of urban living, nature and beyond. Plus celebrate the team's 15th year with a very special anniversary party. In this time of climate crises, reconsider the world around you and experience how environment is everywhere with the Environmental Film Festival 2025. Tickets on sale now at environmentalfilms.org.au.
Presented by Environmental Films Australia, a 3CR supporter.
I'm now joined by multidisciplinary artist Eugenia Lim to discuss her film Metabolism that will screen as part of the Gaza fundraising event for the Environmental Film Festival at Trocadero Projects in Footscray this Friday, the 17th. Metabolism is a film essay that considers the body as land and land as body. Over the course of 9 months, Eugenia spent time talking to and learning from Wadawurrung traditional custodians, researching the Western Treatment Plant, interacting with staff and observing the site. Hi, Eugenia.
Hi,
thanks
Alice.
For joining me in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to sort of start by talking about the physical setting and subject of the film. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I don't know if listeners would have visited, but it's in Werribee, Wadawurrung country, and you smell it before you see it.
Yeah.
It's a vast, amazing landscape. I think it's 110 kilometres squared, like something crazy. It's probably much bigger than that. My maths is not good this time in the morning, but it's as big as Phillip Island, and it has these amazing kind of lagoons or ponds where the treated water, so it's basically water that comes from our bodies and also from industry, it sort of gradually gets treated before it goes to, become irrigation, or it goes out to the sea. So it's a kind of landscape that you can never really see the totality of because it's so vast. And it also is a place of so much life because there's this whole area which is an amazing birding hotspot. And, it's just full of kind of like visiting birds. Yeah. There's frogs, there's insects. So it sort of is like this kind of ecology or body that is there around you. Mm. So when I visited, I kind of just fell in love with it and I wanted to make something in dialogue with it.
Yeah. I did see there's some like ABC, I think, Catalyst little thing about all the birds of Melbourne. And there was a little bit which was about their newfound ecosystem at the plant. So that was, that was very, very interesting. Completely unintentional. I was just watching that and then it came along and I was like, hey, I'm doing my homework on accident. It's very cool.
So good.
I wanted to ask about how this physical place relates to this almost like a greater emergent thing that you've sort of noticed between the way people interact with the land as well.
For sure. I mean, it's something that First Nations mob have known, since time immemorial, that I feel like as a migrant settler, I'm still, kind of coming to terms with. Going to this site that, as you mentioned, is so kind of, it's been so reconstructed and engineered now to sustain, our life in the city, but also, as a sort of interesting, kind of byproduct is now become this incredible habitat for birds. So I think going to that place, sensing it as if it is a digestive system, like it is a kind of stomach, it's sort of like...
you know, it's metabolizing the waste. Exactly. It's like a collective stomach in a way. So you can't help but feel that when you go there because it's like so sensorial. You smell it, you see it, all of the different, like there's fire going that's kind of burning the biogas. Like it's this crazy, body.
Mm.
So it was sort of a bit of an awakening, I think, going there. And seeing it sort of written in that way. But I think through that place, you can kind of start to see it everywhere that you go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that makes me, this is a little bit unrelated, but we are talking about environmental stuff.
Yes.
About how I had a, you know, like a lot of people, I had to sort of slowly realize over time that, of course, our like rubbish networks, like which is sort of the others, because that we're talking about wastewater, but other waste, how there's sort of a myth, like I had this like horrible thing when I was smoking, where I would like put the cigarette into like, I'd be like, I'll go find a bin for this because I don't want to put it on the ground, but like what I'm actually doing is I'm putting that on someone else's ground where I can't see it. And there's not really a you know, and there's, I feel like there's something that we would all benefit from if these, the same way that you take care of your own stomach and you're aware of it and you don't pretend it's not there and you don't like make it someone else's problem, you look after it yourself, how we could like approach that through other versions of waste. Like we do a decent version of clothes where they go to like op shops and stuff, but I do think that the bins and recycling and stuff is a very overlooked part of the
I think if you can make it visible, kind of like draw attention to where it's going. And I think that is the issue being here, you know, in a kind of like Western context where a lot of our landfill and waste is, you know, plastic waste are kind of exported elsewhere. So we don't need to see the consequences of our lifestyle. I think, you know, it's not unrelated to the film in terms of trying to visibilize, you know, I guess the processes that we're part of that have a huge impact on our environment. Like, you know, like you said, even just this one piece of, you know, something, cigarette or whatever that goes to landfill, it has an impact somewhere. Mm. It may not be where we live, but it's where someone else lives or other beings live. So
yeah.
I think the power of film and kind of and art as well is to be able to kind of like transport us to these places where we can't really look away.
Yeah. I was going to talk about this a bit later, but that is the absolute best time to mention that this film is playing for a fundraiser for Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are some, you know, it's kind of, it's a bit hard to talk about because, like, this shouldn't even really be the point, but I guess it's also worth mentioning that there's multiple things happening. Like, there is a genocide happening, but there is an ecocide happening as well.
Exactly.
Like the relentless use of weapons. Like, they, you know, they are primarily human killing, which should be the end of the discussion. But there's more. Like it's, and the other side of that is the effect on the environment. Exactly. And I was wondering about, because I guess in this country, we are very, very slowly, hopefully, you know, on the journey towards reconciliation. And part of that is almost it's actually just good for you, like to live, to, you know, to respect the people who've lived here for a long time, how they describe the structure of the seasons.
Exactly.
You don't, you know, like it should be done for people, but you can also, like, all this stuff is actually just beneficial to everybody involved.
Definitely. I mean, because we're part of nature, right? Like, we are, humans are. So if you kind of care for people who care for the country, then, of course, you know, it's of the benefit to everyone.
Yeah.
And I think definitely, like, watching what's been happening in Gaza and Palestine and just how interconnected genocide is with ecocide, you know, like you can't separate the two. It's devastating to think about because all of those olive trees, like all of the kind of like way of life that's so connected to land, it's, you know, it's systematically being targeted by Israel. And it's not dissimilar to, you know, here what's happening, living in a settler colonial context. That was, you know, what kind of the British settlers came to do, was just kind of set up their British way of life, but totally smashing kind of what the knowledges and the kind of care for country that was here prior. So I think you can sort of also think through that through any place in Australia because it's stolen land. But I think the Wadawurrung site, you know, I mean, a big part of this film came through walking with, you know, with elders, with custodians on country and hearing them talk about the Werribee Yalik, which is the Werribee River, being the spine of country. But we were coming to this site where it borders the Western Treatment Plant and you could still see middens, you know, you could still see these traces of like convivial, like really kind of sustaining life from like, you know, multiple millennia ago. But, you know, the way that the site is now, it's definitely, you know, there's barely any eels that come now. And it's, it is, you can see sort of human traces sort of, yeah, everywhere, but not in a good way now.
Yeah.
So just hearing those stories of kind of times before, really, it kind of made me able to visualize that place through many different timescales and seasons and understand how much is sort of how much transformation has happened there. And it was a really, you know, as an artist or a filmmaker, it's like, oh, there's so much to kind of think about here.
Yeah. I think that might be about all I've got time to talk to you about today. I was just wondering, just quickly before we end, if you have any, you know, things you're currently working on that you'd like to talk about?
Sure. Yeah, I guess coming out of this is I'm hoping to make my first feature film.
Very exciting.
It sounds a bit scary to say because it's like, how the hell will I raise the money?
Documentary or
Yeah, fiction? Like a hybrid documentary. So it'll be between both because I think working in that space is the most interesting part because, you know, even documentary is constructed. It's a narrative.
Yeah.
So I think when you're coming to it with this idea of maybe revealing like larger truths through kind of film practice, that's what I'm really interested in. So I'm actually working on a film that's looking at bird and human migration between here and the Arctic because we're in this like bird superhighway called the East Asian Australasian Flyway. So I'm trying to make this kind of story that's a woven sort of narrative with human and bird characters, so stay tuned.
Cool, awesome. Thank you so much for joining me
in
the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was artist, filmmaker and educator Eugenia Lim discussing Metabolism, an eco-feminist film essay concerned with inner and outer circular economy of the body and its environment. The film will be screening as a part of the Metabolism and Water Ecology's Pay As You Can Gaza Appeal fundraiser for the Environmental Film Festival at Trocadero Projects in Footscray this Friday, the 17th. The event will feature three short films, followed by an artist talk with Eugenia. Tickets can be found by searching for Environmental Film Festival 2025. Links to Eugenia's site and the Environmental Film Festival will be in the show notes.
Amazing. And if you are just joining us this morning, earlier on in the show, we heard a speech delivered by Dr. Sama Sabawi as part of the National Day of Action for Palestine on the 13th of October. And after that, we were joined by Barrister John Lawrence to talk about legally defending direct actioners who have shut down Pine Gap or access to Pine Gap outside of Mpantwa in solidarity with Palestine. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM and it is 8:14 in the morning.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 PM.
News and music from West Papua.
Welcome Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast on 855 AM. And now for a 3CR exclusive with Peter Cronow, who is the editor of Declassified Australia, who joined me this week to discuss the shocking discovery that we knew was there all along, that at least 69 shipments of F-35 fighter jet parts, which is the genocide plane by Lockheed Martin, and likely many more parts, have been flown on commercial passenger planes to Israel from Australia as recently as last week, leaked documents reveal. And Lockheed Martin's F-35 fighter jets have been described as their most lethal stealth fighter jet, playing a critical role in the genocide in Gaza, in Palestine, as well as other global atrocities. Now, this comes after years of denial by the Department of Defense, Parliament members and the Prime Minister saying Australia does not supply weapons or parts of weapons to Israel and hasn't done so for more than 5 years. Now, Peter is an investigative journalist, highly esteemed, won numerous awards, and Declassified Australia is uncovering Australia's secret global impact. So let's take a listen to this first part of our interview.
Thank you, Ines.
Thank you. It's such an important topic that you've written about in Declassified Australia. So I thought we'd start off with, you know, the details of these shipping records that are confidential has listed a total of 68 shipments of F-35 Joint Striker Fighter air parts that have been flown from Australia directly to Israel between October 2023 and as recently as a few weeks ago in September 2025. How is this happening in secret?
Well, and as I can just update you that there's been an extra flight that went late last week. So that's 69 now. And
wow.
It seems to be a regular pattern of export from Australia using commercial airplanes to do it, because they just think it's quiet and it's under the radar and nobody will know about it. So we'll just pump them out via just put them in a package and stick them with one of the couriers and off they go. It's a huge trade of parts going to Israel secretly, which has been regularly denied in Parliament. The support for Israel during this period of 2 years it's not a battle, it's not a war, it's a genocide. No sanctions, no boycotts. And in fact, it's been facilitating exports of these military parts to Israel.
Honestly, not shocked, but really wanted to know more about why is it commercial planes? And I know that in your article, you had reached out to the Department of Defense and had no reply. But why do you think it's been commercial planes?
Well, I think the parts are small and regular, and there's nothing explosive in them. They're not actually bombs or anything similar. They're little parts that make the planes, the F-35s, work. Little pieces, little actuators for the tail fin, all sorts of very small parts, which can just really be stuck in a reinforced cardboard box and stuck onto a courier. Now, why they're doing that, I think they know it's under the radar and nobody knows about it, so therefore they can just continue doing it. It's become clear that the parts are actually owned by Lockheed Martin, because the crazy situation with parts for the Australian F-35s that are at Tyndall and at Williamtown Air Force Base is that all the spare parts that Australia has waiting there to be fitted upon the planes as they wear out or break and need maintenance on, all of those spare parts, until they actually get screwed onto the plane, are the possession, are the ownership of Lockheed Martin. As soon as a part gets taken off the plane, if it's broken or worn out, it stops being Australia's possession and goes back to being Lockheed Martin. So we would have hundreds of parts for our fleet of F-35s. It just seems that those parts forever remain in the global supply train and can be grabbed by any country that happens to need a part that it doesn't have. And the parts are being sent over, presumably by Lockheed Martin, which has an office, a warehouse at Williamtown at the Air Force Base. The ability to send them on commercial aeroplanes is just basically that's an easy way of doing it. Imagine the cost if you had to hire a separate cargo plane, or if you had to hire or use a military plane. It just wouldn't happen. These parts are being sent out as they're needed. As whenever they get an order or request in, they hunt around the global supply chain, they can't find anything really easily at any other location. Australia's got some parts, so they go in a box and off they go. The whole point being that the global supply chain is not owned by Australia, even when all those parts are on the shelves of Australian Air Force bases.
Yeah, it sounds really duplicitous, and everything can kind of be explained away with some sort of technicality. Parliament members have infamously stated that it's only the parts that are being flown and they're non-lethal, but F-35 Joint Striker Jets are the genocide aircraft. And even though the parts are non-lethal, they've also involved any involvement in direct shipping. Why is Parliament skating by on these technicalities and presenting them as like parts non-lethal? We don't have any involvement in it.
Well, the public support for Palestine is huge in Australia. It's a very controversial and touchy topic for a supposed left of centre Labor government. You know, the talking points have moved from the very simplified version, just trying to get the questioner in Parliament off their back or the journalist off their back. So initially the explanation was, we supply no weapons to Israel and we haven't done so for 5 years. Well, it depends on your definition of weapons. The definition of weapons they seem to use is at variance from the internationally accepted definition of weapons, which includes weapons and weapons parts. The next time they're asked a question, it would be, oh, well, we might be sending a few parts, but that's because it's part of the global supply chain and that's quite separate. That's got nothing to do with us. They go over to America. In fact, one of them said they go off to America and we lose sight of them. We don't have any control over them. Okay, well, that didn't wash. So the next answer provided was, those parts. Yeah, okay, well, we do send parts. We do. We actually send parts into the global supply chain. They get over there to Israel, but they're non-lethal parts, you know. They're things that operate the bomb doors or little push rods that operate the tail or the visor for the helmet for the pilot. You can't kill anyone with that, so they're non-lethal.
Absolutely outrageous.
It's incredible to suggest that. Now, that was held down when that was said in Parliament by the Foreign Minister. Since then, they've moved on to a new description. They're now saying we don't supply weapons or parts. They had been saying we don't supply weapons and ammunition. They're saying they don't supply weapons or parts except to the global supply chain. Well, the thing is that what we've discovered is it might be global supply chain, but it's going directly from Sydney Airport onto a commercial plane and flying to, via Bangkok off to Tel Aviv. When a part is urgently needed in Israel, they go direct and they go from the airport and they go on the next available commercial plane.
Well, just to give the skeptic in me some leniency, I guess, and play devil's advocate, are there any other possible explanations? You know, I've seen people say they've been sent for repair, or yeah, sure, they're being sent to Tel Aviv, but we don't know exactly where they're going or if they're actually being used.
Well, there's always an explanation if you ask a politician.
Yeah. Yes, because, very true.
Because that was one explanation put around, and that was that... those parts, they're not lethal. Anyway, they're our parts that are broken. We're just sending them to Israel for repair. And when they're repaired, they're sent back here. Well, the lie in that, and I'm not denying that some parts may be sent over and brought back to Australia, but the lie in that can be seen by something like the rudder on the tail of the F-35 has a little hydraulic mechanism that pushes the tail and moves it back and forward, you know, quite complex. And one of the tie rods was one of the parts that was being sent over there for the tail mechanism. Now, those tie rods are made in Melbourne. That Melbourne company has proudly announced that they do all the repair and maintenance of all the tie rods for the tails and other parts of the plane for all the F-35s in Australia. So you've got to ask yourself the question, how likely is it that Australia would package up one of those little tie rods into a box, put it onto a plane, send it 14,000 kilometres to Israel to have it repaired when the repair base is already here in Melbourne?
Very true, because it's a very short flight.
That applies to lots of the parts that we've had a really close look at. The parts that are on the list are very, you know, weirdly titled. Actuator, IRCM. Now, what's an IRCM? Well, we did a bit of digging and you find out that an IRCM is the infrared countermeasures. So it's the little rod that opens the door that pumps out the flares that stops missiles hitting the F-35 when it's passing by, dropping its bombs on people. The likelihood of missiles being fired at an F-35 is pretty low, but it is an essential part of the F-35 ability to get to certain locations to drop bombs, the ability for it to defend itself. Well, those little actuators are helping doing that. And you know what? They're made in Melbourne too. So why we would be sending them 14,000 kilometres to Israel is a hard thing to ask. Now, Lockheed Martin's got an office, a headquarters in Tel Aviv. However, these parts, once they've landed in Tel Aviv off the commercial flight, are then being trucked down to Nevatim Air Force Base, where the Israeli F-35s are kept. Looks extremely unlike being repaired, sent to an Air Force base rather than being sent to the factory, and the fact that we can repair these things here ourselves. So
I'm so curious about the record keeping of this, because if they say that there's nothing wrong with just sending parts off to be, you know, repaired or whatever excuse they have, but then what about export permits? As you said, like, why are they labeling them in very strange names? Why not just put up the records, and then would there be any more parts floating around than we actually know about? And that was part one of a 3CR exclusive with myself and Peter Cornell, who is editor of Declassified Australia and investigative journalist with numerous awards, talking about how there is a shocking discovery that at least 69 shipments of F-35 fighter jet parts, and likely many more, have been flown on commercial passenger planes to Israel from Australia via Bangkok as recently as last week. And this is continuously happening on an ongoing basis. And next week, we'll learn more about the Freedom of Information request, the Department of Defense's defensive reply, and what is next for the Williamtown base as the main F-35 base for the Asia-Pacific region.
This is a message from Footscray Community Response. For generations, Footscray has been a place of welcome for people from all walks of life. Despite some of the rhetoric, it is not even in the top 10 of so-called Melbourne communities for crime. It remains a relatively safe and vibrant place to live. But life in Footscray has become hard for many people. Our government is actively, literally destroying the housing and services that create safety and stability for all. The housing and cost of living crises are having an impact, and we have all witnessed more people who are sleeping rough, unwell, or otherwise in need. Shamefully, Maribyrnong Council have responded to these needs by spending $100,000 on security guards to patrol Central Footscray. We know, and the evidence tells us, that security responses like this do not work. What works is people supporting each other and governments providing the housing and services that we need. Join us on Saturday, November 15th to take back the mall and show the council and the state government that people are not problems to be surveilled and moved on. People are what make Footscray great. November 15th, Nicholson Street Mall. Kids and families are welcome. There will be face paint if we can organise it. Prize for any child that comes in fancy dress. If you want to contribute, bring food, whatever, please reach out and let us know. We're going to decorate a banner from 11 and then people will talk about their experiences in the mall.
And also a reminder for next week, Homeless Persons Union is having a speak out at Melbourne Town Hall starting at 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, the 21st of October. So a lot happening in the space looking at homelessness, justice and access to public space and the way that these councils are cracking down on the poorest members of our community. Now, that is about all we've got time for on today's show. As a reminder, we heard from Sama Sabawi, John Lawrence, Eugenia Lim, and finally Peter Cronow. And make sure to tune into Thursday Morning Breakfast next week to catch the second part of Inez's interview with Peter Cronow. And for now, we will let you go, but have a wonderful day, and we'll catch you again next week on Thursday Breakfast. Stay tuned for Lost in Science.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.